late Karen Johnson Boyd. She died in 2016 at the age of 91. Over four decades, the only sibling of the late Sam Johnson of S.C. Johnson fame donated over 1,700 pieces of art. She was particularly interested in contemporary American craft and works on paper. This summer, the museum's galleries will highlight separate themes related to Mrs. Boyd and her donations. Coming up now on 11 Minutes After 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers and Cubs were off yesterday. The White Sox beat Minnesota 6-5. Here's the schedule for tonight. Now the Brewers will host the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Cubbies play the Cardinals. That game is in St. Louis. And the White Sox host the Twins again. NBA playoffs, yesterday's winners were Cleveland and Boston. And a local note, the Wisconsin Marathon returns to Kenosha tomorrow morning. Some 2,000 runners in downtown Kenosha and north and south along the lakefront. So watch for road closures downtown and along the race route near the lakefront through the morning hours. Now the forecast details from the National Weather Service for the morning hours, because it'll change for the afternoon. For the morning hours, cloudy, windy, and warm. A 40% chance of rain developing late this morning. Also, wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour. Then for the afternoon hours, sunny and warm, a high of 73. Tonight, clear and mild, a low of 53. And tomorrow for the big race, sunny and warm, a high of 78. At the start of the race at 7 o'clock, it should be in the upper 50s or low 60s. Right now, wind from the west-southwest at 26 miles per hour. Some clouds, some sunshine. Had a little bit of a temperature drop, 58 degrees in Racine, 59 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:12, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, the Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. In today's morning show, Greg will be talking to the author of a book called Play On. It's a book about elite athletes with exceptionally long careers.
Jeff Bercovici, I want to talk first about you and your own sort of athletic odyssey, as it will. You spend a little bit of time in the book talking about this, and of course, you come to this whole question of athletic durability and maybe let's call it sustainability as someone who has been an athlete and wants to remain an athlete, but has faced a few barriers and issues that have, in a sense, complicated that pursuit. Just say a word about your own kind of athletic experience, and particularly in more recent years, in the way in which the issues and topic of this book are very personal for you.
Absolutely. This book basically grew out of my experience as, well, calling me an athlete is probably, devaluing that term a little bit, but I'm someone who grew up, and I grew up in Milwaukee. I had a sort of played all the normal sports as a kid, and then kind of as most of us do, it fell away as I reached adulthood and started working. In my 30s, I started getting really active again. I got really back into soccer in a big way. I was playing recreationally a few times a week, and it's something I was really excited about, and feeling like I had this cool feeling of it's not too late for me to enjoy a really great athletic life. But the problem was, the more I got into it, and the more I played, my body was just not holding up. It was really the first time that I realized what it means physically to be 35 versus 25. And these injuries just kind of stacked up one on top of each other until I got injured so badly. I herniated two discs in my back in this really bizarre way that forced me to get emergency surgery. My doctor said if I'd gone another day or two, I probably would have had some permanent paralysis from it. At that point, I took a step back, and as somebody who's also a big sports fan, I knew what was going on in the world of sports, where you have a lot of the biggest superstars in the world, really people like Roger Federer, Serena Williams, Tom Brady, who either were my age or even older, and were playing their best, the best that they ever had in their careers. And I knew a little bit about some of the things that they were doing in terms of changes they were making to their training, changes they were making to their diet, some sort of more exotic medical procedures that they were having. And I just said, if they're doing this stuff and it's working for them this well, there's got to be stuff that I can extract from that and apply to my life as really, a person who puts very modest athletic demands on my body, but there's got to be stuff that translates. So that's how I got into it.
By the way, I think it's really important at this point to acknowledge that that the Roger Federers of the world, the Peyton Mannings of the world are one side of this story. But by no means can we sort of say across the board that all elite athletes and professional athletes are playing longer and playing better and so on. We also have all kinds of instances of athletes where, in a sense, the opposite is the case. And they burn out, their bodies break down, and so on. So it is not just sort of the inevitable blessing of living right now when we know all of this about the human body, that you are destined to have a longer career than someone a couple of decades ago. You still have to make the right choices. And it looks like in some ways it's even more important to make the right choices for fear of ending up with injury and other health complications that you will simply not be able to surmount.
That's so true. It's worth restating that Federer, we all talk about him because he's such an exception in so many ways, and his durability is something that probably doesn't get appreciated, because it gets eclipsed by his virtuosity. But he has just been a marvel and his career has spanned an era when tennis has gotten so much more demanding and really damaging for the body in every way. They play more of the calendar. They're playing on harder surfaces. They're playing with equipment that demands a lot more strength and sends a lot more vibration into their arms and shoulders. So, and you're seeing this across sports. Even as you're seeing all the things that I document in my book that are helping athletes stay healthier, you also have all these changes across sports, most of which are driven by money in one way or another, that are making it actually physically harder for them to stay healthy. But on balance, the trend is, where we have good statistics, the trend is that we are seeing more players who are at least capable of performing the way that, to their best at age 35 or age 40 in a way that we weren't maybe a few years ago.
How difficult was it for you to gain the access that you did to some of these elite athletes and their trainers and handlers? I mean, we sometimes imagine such people living and working behind a fairly thick veil of let's say, secrecy.
Yeah, absolutely. There are all kinds of instances of especially teams that have invested a lot of money in advanced medical and training facilities that think that they're getting some kind of advantage out of it and want to keep that secret for as long as they can. I would say it really was all over the place because you do have some athletes who are very secretive about it. you know, I was told by there's a Japanese sports tech company called Katsu that makes this this really cool blood flow restriction training system. And the founder of that company, he said basically all the Japanese baseball players he knows in Major League Baseball are using this, but most of them don't want to talk about it because they think it gives them an advantage and you know, they don't want to tip their secrets. On the other hand, you have a lot of athletes who are so proud of what they've done. You know, they know better than anybody how hard it is to be playing your best, you know, after 10 or 15 years in the league. And they want everybody to know it. You know, they really want to brag about it. I mean, Donald Driver was somebody I interviewed who just was, he loves talking about it. You know, he has no shame over being an older athlete. You know, he wasn't worried about being seen as like not marketable or anything because of it. He wanted to share what he knows with other people. Hmm.
I appreciated the fact that you write this book in a way that where it can really make sense to those of us who are even less athletes than you are, and unacquainted with a lot of what's going on here, including the science, which is, of course, one of the most fascinating facets to all of this. How much did you know about science before going into this project, and what kind of learning curve did you have to, in a sense, experience in order to be able to write about this as thoroughly and comprehensively as you do?
I think as a journalist, I'm pretty scientifically literate to begin with. Probably, you know, I've always been really interested in science and done as much science writing as I can figure out how to squeeze into my workload. And you know, my day job covering technology helps a lot. I cover technology and startups for Inc., the business magazine, and that helps a great deal because there are a lot of really interesting, you know, biotech companies, for instance, medical companies, sports tech companies that are doing novel things that I need to be able to A, understand, and B, explain to the readers. So I, you know, I have that part of my sort of tool chest, but also I would say, as a journalist, I see my job usually as parachuting into stories where, you know, I need to get up to speed really fast. I'm more of a student than a teacher, or I guess I start as a student and then I become a teacher by the end of my process. So definitely, I was learning on the fly a lot, and a lot of these experts, you know, in particular, a lot of the sports scientists who spent some real time helping me get educated were just invaluable to me.
We're speaking with Jeff Berkovici about his book, Play On, The New Science of Elite Performance at Any Age. I also appreciate the fact that your book spans a number of different sports, and both team sports and individual sports, and also covers the bases in, for instance, the span between explosive athletes and endurance athletes. And that is a distinction that probably a lot of us might sort of understand if we take the time to stop and think about it. But it's a crucial distinction when it comes to athletes being able to sustain their careers because they involve very different kinds of training. Explain the heart and soul of the difference between explosive athletes and endurance athletes and how they need to approach this whole matter of training differently.
So generally, the rule of thumb is that endurance athletes have an easier time staying competitive as they get into their 30s, you know, some cases even into their 40s. The longer the competition is that they're doing, the later they tend to reach the peaks of their career. So, for instance, you know, peak age for middle distance runners is somewhere around 28. For marathoners, it might be around you know, 30 or 32, and for ultramarathoners, it'll be even higher, maybe around 35. That has to do with physiology, basically the physiology of aging. You tend to you have two different types of muscle fibers. You have your what are colloquially known as quick twitch and slow twitch muscle fibers. The quick twitch ones are the ones that give you that sort of explosive strength, and those disappear more quickly. You know, we all lose muscle fiber as we age. Athletes, you know, the more active you are, the more successful you hang on to it, but we all do experience some of it, and your quick twitch muscle fibers basically die off a little more easily and a little earlier in life. So therefore, that's the big mechanism that tends to make people explosive athletes slower as they age. When you hear, you know, this wide receiver or this basketball player has lost a step, what they're talking about in many cases is they've lost that explosiveness that comes from having a really high proportion of quick twitch muscle fibers in their muscles.
Hmm. This conversation or this particular discussion comes in the midst of a chapter called Fresh is the New Fit, a better way to think about conditioning. And I think some of the most interesting observations in this chapter come from somebody who is a Dutch soccer coach who really takes serious issue with the way that most soccer teams, professional soccer teams around the world, train their athletes. Could you say a word about this gentleman and his concerns and his own philosophy?
Yeah, I love this guy. His name is Raymond Verheijen, and he's written a couple books about his experience of training and what he thinks is wrong with athletic training in European soccer and in other sports across the world. He had pretty unkind things to say about the NFL too. He's a very, very outspoken man, and basically his beef is with this idea that a lot of coaches have that what you need to do is break your players down to build them back up, that the way to train players is to train them so hard that once they get onto the field that it's easy for them to play, because anything that they've experienced in their training is basically, you know, is harder than anything they experience in a live game situation. The problem with this that he identified is that you build up fatigue in your body. The more you train, the more fatigue you build up. And if you train so much that your body doesn't get a chance to adequately recover, you carry that fatigue from one workout to the next, from one game to the next. And that fatigue, not only does it make you perform worse, it actually makes you more likely to get injuries. It literally slows down how quickly your nerves send impulses to your muscles and cause you to react to unexpected situations. And therefore, you get those sorts of contact injuries or non-contact injuries that we see so much of. So this approach, he's been sort of a leading proponent of this approach in European soccer, and but in the U.S., it really came to us through Greg Popovich, who coaches the San Antonio Spurs, and who about 15 years ago started, he felt like fatigue was really holding a lot of his players back, so he started resting healthy players during the season. He would just, sit some of his best players for a game if he thought they needed a break, which sounds so, ordinary to us now. At the time, it was really controversial. He was getting fined. The league would fine him $30,000 if he wanted to sit out one of his good players, because they said you're depriving the fans of the players that they paid to see. But his record was so amazing after he started doing this, in terms of the injury rate on his teams and the winning rate, and the fact that he almost always had one of the oldest teams in the league, that basically it completely inverted the conventional wisdom around athletic conditioning in the NBA, and now every team thinks that the best thing to do is sit your healthy players as often as you can before the playoffs, and it's trickled out to other sports too. So that's what it comes down to, is balancing. Of course you need to be fit to compete as an athlete, but you need to be fresh too.
Compare this with a term that was absolutely brand new to me until I read it in your book in this same chapter, the term progressive overload, which you tell us dates back to actually the Second World War and the rehabilitation of soldiers.
Progressive overload is the basis of athletic training. It's what athletic training is. It's the idea that you push your, you push your muscles, you push your respiratory system a little harder than it's really comfortable going, and then you're tired. Your muscles are literally, your muscle fibers are a little bit broken down from the effort, and for a couple days after that, you're weaker, you're slower, something's been taken out of you. But then when you recover, not only do you recover to the level of that you were before the effort, but you recover and you strengthen. Your muscles get stronger. You develop new red blood cells. All sorts of adaptations happen, and you get stronger. So then you do your next workout from that stronger starting point, and the same thing happens. You break down. You recover. and you build up a little higher than you started. So stacking those gains on top of one another is what it means, is what progressive overload means.
Interesting. And of course, this is something that could potentially be taken too far.
Yes. And that basically is what Raymond Verheijen and Greg Popovich were putting their fingers on. Mm-hmm. That if you take out that recovery period, then not only are you not getting those gains, you're actually getting slower and weaker, and of course more likely to injury. And in the extreme cases, this results in something that's called overtraining syndrome, where all sorts of nasty things happen. Your immune system completely craters. You can't sleep. You start, you losing hair. You're getting sick all the time. So overtraining syndrome is something, especially that's a problem with endurance athletes, but it's a problem with all athletes, because the fact is, the people who are elite performers are that way because they are capable of pushing themselves so hard, they often will ignore these signals that they need to take a break, or even that they need to just dial back their training.
Right. By the way, I should mention that in this same chapter, you write about your encounter with the Green Bay Packers in training camp, I think back in 2011. And, of course, with all kinds of Green Bay Packers fans listening to this interview, and you're talking to one right now, I sure want to make sure that you have a couple of minutes to talk about your encounter with the legendary Donald Driver and how his philosophy of training and the training of the Green Bay Packers, at least at that point in time, folds into what we are talking about here.
Donald Driver, it was such an interesting conversation because he is, obviously he had, a tremendous amount of success in his career, incredibly disciplined person, often was said that he was the fittest guy on the team, the strength coaches loved him. And what he told me is that the reason he survived so long in the league is, he said two things. He said, first of all, on his first day in the league, on his first day at a Packers training camp, Brett Favre said, listen, never show a man when you're hurt, because if you're hurt, they're going to come after you where you're hurt. But then the other thing he said is that he said, I work harder than anybody else. I tell all the young guys, when you're sleeping, I'm working. And he would say, for instance, that he wouldn't let himself drink water on game days, because he thinks, ever since he was a kid coming up in football, that he was told that water weakens your body, water makes you soft. Now, that's a great example of an athlete who had a specific set of practices, had a huge amount of success, and sort of makes a connection that isn't 100% there, Because now we see this sort of idea that when you're working, I'm sleeping. Well, the what you hear now from athletes, the best informed athletes, the ones who really embrace this new approach to conditioning, is that sleeping is working. Now you hear LeBron James or Federer or Shalane Flanagan, who just won the New York Marathon, you hear them saying they brag about how much they sleep. They brag about getting 12 hours of sleep a night when they're in competition, because they know that is often, especially when you're in the middle of competition or getting really close to competition, that time actually makes more of a difference than the time they're spending in the gym.
Interesting. This reminds me of something elsewhere in the book where you talk about, in a sense, the maybe public relations problem that, at least to some extent, this kind of new understanding and this sort of caution and restraint can be a little bit of an issue. Do you mind if I just read the paragraph in question, and then I'll have you comment on it? Is that okay?
Great.
So, again, this is still from that chapter called Fresh is the New Fit. You write, whereas coaches once thought in terms of how much load their players could sustain without a breakdown, now the smart ones focus on how little training they can get by on without a decrease in performance. But there's a problem with that formulation. It doesn't square with how we like to think about elite athletes. We get a kick from thinking about Adrian Peterson running 300-meter sprints under a Texas sun, or Carly Lloyd spending her Christmas morning doing push-ups and sit-ups. We love hearing Donald Driver say, when you're sleeping, I'm working, or Yair Jagr announcing physically, I don't get tired. It gratifies our desire for moral order in sports. We want the longest careers, like championship trophies, to be enjoyed by athletes who want it the most. It inspires us, and inspiration is a big part of of what those of us who aren't elite athletes crave from those who are. No pain, no gain may be a recipe for failure, but it looks good plastered on the wall of a gym. Do just enough, not so much. So how much of an issue do you think this actually is?
I think it is harder to sell things like sneakers or sports drinks without without that notion of extreme effort. You know, extreme effort, extreme exertion. Yeah, absolutely. You know, of course, we want to think that the athlete who works out the hardest is the one who wins in the end, instead of the one who, you know, instead of attributing it to genetic success, genetic luck, which of course is such a huge part of it. Or something like discipline about going to bed at the same time every night. That's just not a sexy thing to talk about as a sports fan. But you know, that's the truth now. It really is about being, you know, as they say, train smarter, not harder, or training a little less. It's athletes suffer from this thing that they call commission bias, which is they always want to do more. You know, they feel like they want to have control of their success or failure. So if they have any extra time, they want to get back in that gym. I was, in the introductory chapter, I talk about going to this training camp where a bunch of NFL players, it was like a pre-preseason training camp, and I was watching all these NFL players training. And Colin Kaepernick, the head of NFL training there, put them through some very specific football drills, and then he said, everybody, your job now is to go home and spend the next few hours recovering. You've taken money out of the bank, now you got to put it back in your bank. And then I went to the gym where I watched Colin Kaepernick spend the next 4 hours lifting every piece of metal in the gym. You know, that's how these people are. They if there's something they think they can do, they do it. And that's why we see – that's why so often they're doing things that they're doing a lot of things that work for them, but they're also doing a lot of things that aren't proven to work, that, you know, might be wasting their time or money or even, you know, maybe holding back their performance a little, but they're doing it because they think that there's that 1% chance that it might make a difference when it comes to that next championship or the next contract.
Right. That reminds me that one of the most intriguing chapters of the book, which I don't think we'll have any time to talk about very thoroughly at least, is the chapter titled Careful What You Swallow, in which you talk about how, of course, there have been tremendous breakthroughs made in the whole area of nutrition, but that in this field there are also all kinds of passing fads that a lot of athletes desperate to either achieve their highest potential or maintain their level of skill will gravitate towards just about anything that they are told will make a difference, including some things that perhaps don't help them at all and maybe inadvertently are even hurting them.
Yeah, fad diets in general tend to be, there's just not a ton of new information on nutrition that actually makes a difference. Basically, you want to eat mostly unprocessed foods, mostly vegetables, mostly lean meats, and if you're doing those things, not eating a ton of sugar, you're getting all the benefits of any fad diet. So when Tom Brady says that his diet works because he doesn't eat strawberries or, you know, he hasn't eaten a piece of chocolate in 5 years or whatever, no, his diet works because he's eating mostly vegetables, he's eating mostly lean meats. Again, it's this idea that I can have control by doing something extreme that it's very hard to give up.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jeff Berkovici, author of Play On, The New Science of Elite Performance at Any Age. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Oh, sure.
Great. I'm enjoying this very, very much. One of the things that I think is quite intriguing is the chapter in your book that explores movement. The chapter is titled Ferraris and Toyotas, in which we have certain athletes who are discovering that the way they move can have a huge bearing on their durability as athletes. And you point to two different athletes in particular as shining success stories, quarterback Peyton Manning and the aforementioned tennis superstar Roger Federer. Explain to our listeners what lessons these two remarkable athletes have to teach us when it comes to this matter of movement?
So Roger Federer and Peyton Manning are, in a way, they're opposite examples, because Federer is somebody who has had this amazing career of almost no injuries. In an era when tennis is so punishing for the body, he has missed fewer tournaments than pretty much anyone who has played over the same period of time. Peyton Manning, on the other hand, of course, famously has had a large number of pretty serious injuries, you know, including a number of neck surgeries that really affected his arm strength. So Federer is, I mean, if you talk to any biomechanicist, you know, any kinesiologist, they will say Federer is sort of this, you know, the ideal of perfect movement. He moves so effortlessly. His what you call the kinetic chain. It's the sort of process by which you transfer energy from one part of your body to another. His kinetic chain is perfect. He never he's never running any faster than he needs to get to the ball. He's never swinging any harder than he needs to hit the shot he wants to hit. Whereas Peyton Manning had reached this place where all of his injuries had resulted in what they call compensations, where, you know, if you're not getting enough strength out of your legs because your knee is injured, let's say, but you still have to throw a ball, a football 40 yards, so maybe now you're working your shoulder and your arm a little harder. So Peyton Manning was, you know, the last couple of years of his career, he was really limited by injury. And I talked to this guy, Mackie Shillstone, who is he calls himself the career extender. He's sort of an all-around physical guru to a lot of athletes, like Serena Williams is his other most famous client. He had to work with Peyton to teach him basically how to throw a football again. Peyton, we said, you know, I want to come back. I want to play one more season because I think I can win another Super Bowl, but I don't know if I can do it. And so Mackie Shillstone spent the summer teaching him. What he had him do was stand on a balance beam so that he could learn to use the strength from his legs to drive the football instead of arming it.
Fascinating. And of course, this is someone who already really knew how to throw a football, but this was a way for him to throw a football in a way that would be kinder to his own body.
Yeah, it's all about these compensations that sort of, you know, your body becomes, your movement becomes a map of your past injuries. And now what we're seeing is a number of companies, of technology companies, that are saying basically that they can read that map. They can measure an athlete's movement in different ways, whether through motion capture systems like the ones that they do to produce like video games, or through force plates, which measure the force that you put into the ground as you jump. And basically using machine learning, they can identify these patterns in your movement that, if they continue, they're going to lead to specific injuries. And then they retrain you so that you change your movement patterns to become healthier. So that basically the idea is we would all learn to move like Roger Federer, and we would all, you know, be as healthy as him.
Hmm. By the way, I appreciated your discussion about Roger Federer and his tremendous success, and I appreciated the fact that you also talked about his great rival, Rafael Nadal, who happens to be my favorite tennis player. And as you talk about the difference between them and the fact that Rafael Nadal has not avoided injury at all in the way that Roger Federer has, and it has so much to do with the way Rafael Nadal throws himself around the court and just is almost brutal to his own body in the way that he plays tennis. That's probably why I love him and why a lot of people love to watch him play. But it is also the very thing that has kept him off the court as much as it has and impeded him from achieving probably the success that could have been his. Not that he hasn't been tremendously successful, but he would probably have even more trophies on his case if perhaps he was making other choices about the way he plays and the way he trains, unless there is something about him in which the system adapted by Roger Federer simply wouldn't work for him. But it's so intriguing to think about these two athletes who are so different from each other. Tremendous rivals, great friends, but poles apart in many respects.
It's so wonderful that they played. I mean, I think we all love both of them more because the other one exists. But yeah, Rafa is, you know, he does satisfy that craving for moral order that you quoted before, because you look at his body and you say, okay, I can see how hard this guy works. You look at the effort he puts into every match, you can say, I see how much he wants this, and it's impossible not to cheer for him. But you know, he reminds me of Tiger. He makes me think of Tiger Woods, who, I mean, everybody who likes golf remembers what a phenomenon it was when Tiger came up and he was lifting weights, and he had these huge arms, and he was hitting the ball faster than anybody had ever hit it off the tee, and it caused a revolution in golf. But then, you know, now 20 years later, he's saying, I trained too much. You know, I was bulkier and more muscular than I needed to be. I did all these long runs before tournaments that damaged my joints, damaged my spine. And he's saying the reason he's able to make a comeback now is because he's finally learned to scale it back, to rest when he needs to rest, and that was the key.
Hmm. Some of what we're talking about with Peyton Manning and Roger Federer reminds me of an equally fascinating conversation or discussion in the eighth chapter of your book, which is called Slow is Fast, Strategy, Complexity, and the Advantages of Experience. It is not exactly the same thing, but in some respects, certainly related. Explain this notion of slow is fast, and particularly one quote that is so intriguing: "Slow is smooth, and smooth is fast." I mean, it's a way to kind of rethink some of these notions that we can approach too simplistically.
So that quote, "slow is smooth and smooth is fast," is something I heard from the head psychologist for the Navy SEALs. He was saying that's something that gets drilled into every special operator's head, because when you are in a life or death situation, that it's so much better to be the guy who shoots last than the guy who shoots first. You know, he said, you're not just, you know, you have a limited amount of ammo, you're giving away your position to the enemy. You want to take one shot, and you want that shot to matter. So they really teach them to slow down their actions. Don't, you know, because panic makes you want to speed up. And that's something that you see so much in sports. You know, there's this cliche that after you've been playing, you know, whatever sport it is, you know, I played for a couple years and the game slowed down, or I was in the zone that day and it just felt like everything was happening in slow motion. And that really is, that happens because of this, you know, largely, I should say, because of this phenomenon called chunking, where in mentally complex situations, if you chunk together different pieces of information and perceive them as sort of as units, as related units, you can process a lot more information more quickly. An easy example to think of is if you see the shift happening in baseball. You know, you see one player moving his position, and all of a sudden, you know, this defense is playing the shift. I know exactly where everyone's going to be on the field without having to look at it. Because of that kind of process, athletes who have, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years of experience in a sport can make decisions so much faster than somebody who just came into the league and is overwhelmed by all that complexity. And the truth is, in a lot of sports, it's not the fastest. It's not the fastest player on the field. You know, the fastest runner who is the best player. You know, there's a reason Usain Bolt doesn't just dominate every sport in the world. Carly Lloyd, the great soccer player, I talked to her coach, and he was telling me he actually had to teach her to run slower, because, you know, you can't outrun the ball, and if you're trying, you're doing the wrong thing. In so many, he said, fast minds are always going to beat fast feet.
I like that. As you say it in this chapter, as athletes accumulate experience within their sports, they become more efficient processors of information. Put more briefly, the longer you play, the faster you think. And I suppose this is as good a time to remind ourselves that when we're talking about older athletes, we're often talking about older athletes who are in their 30s. And, of course, if we were talking about older athletes who are in their 70s, maybe some of those faculties for processing information do indeed start to slow down. But the so-called aged elite professional athlete is still at an age where mentally they should be incredibly sharp, and experience can make them sharper.
That's true, although, you know, there has also been a lot of research that's come out in the last few years that has shown that exercise, in particular, really intense exercise, has these amazing effects. I mean, it's power to arrest or even reverse temporarily some of the processes of aging is much greater than we ever appreciated, to the degree that, you know, if you measure somebody's biological age, what they call biological age, in terms of what their life expectancy is compared to other people of the same age, somebody who's really fit in their 70s can have the same biological age as somebody who's 40. You know, that's how big the effect is.
Wow. I want to make sure before you go that we talk for a moment about the kind of psychological aspect of all of this that you explore in the chapter called Consistency is a Talent, the psychology of athletes who get better with age. And this is also, of course, closely related to some of what we were just talking about. I think in this chapter, the insight that I found most interesting of all is when you talk about, in a sense, the challenge that the typical sports psychologist faces in dealing with elite athletes and trying to work with them and to say what they need to say most effectively. At one point, you say, lecturing the world's hardiest warriors on the finer points of toughness is an undertaking that itself requires no small amount of intestinal fortitude. Explain to our listeners what you're getting at here.
There's this sort of a narrow path that an athlete has to travel down to be to both become an elite athlete in the first place, and then to stay an elite athlete. You know, you have to be somebody who obviously really cares about your performance. You really care about winning, but you also have to be able to put your mistakes behind you immediately as soon as they happen. You know, you have to be able to accept defeat. Not only accept defeat, you have to be able to enjoy defeat. Really, you know, you have to be able to enjoy efforts that weren't successful as much as efforts that were successful. What I say, based on what a lot of sports psychologists told me, is that basically to become an elite athlete in the first place, you have to be able to treat a game like it's your job. You know, approach it with that kind of same effort and discipline every day. You know, all aspects of your life have to come under that discipline. But then to be able to remain an elite athlete for 20 years, the truth is, you have to be able to approach your job like it's a game. Meaning you have to have fun with every part of it. And I mean, this sounds like almost too good to be true. But anybody who knows Roger Federer will tell you he loves tennis more than anybody else who plays tennis, and that's why he's been able to do what he does. I mean, John McEnroe said that about him. John McEnroe knows every great tennis player of the last 50 years. You know, Michael Jordan was the same way. Michael Jordan loved basketball so much in practices, he had that love of the game clause that would allow him to play even in the off season. It's so often, I mean, the magical ingredient that separates these players from everybody else is actually how much they love playing the game. Tom Brady, after winning his last Super Bowl, he said, "There's two things that I love to do: play football and prepare to play football." You know, a guy whose favorite thing in the world is going to practices and memorizing playbooks. I mean, that's somebody who seriously might still be winning championships when he's 50.
Hmm. I think we've done a nice job of exploring many facets of the book, and we have by no means explored them all. We, for instance, have not explored the whole notion of recovery, of the new understanding that trainers have and athletes have about the importance of recovery, and have not talked about the chapter in which you explore some of the remarkable breakthroughs when it comes to sports surgery and so on. But what I want to finish with is another important facet of the book that I don't think we've really touched on at all. The first line of the introduction touches on it. Here's the first line of the book. "I'm halfway through the most grueling 4 minutes of my life, wondering how I'm going to survive the next 120 seconds. This points to the fact that you not only write about the training of elite athletes, but at many points during the book, you are right there in the trenches, engaged in some of this same training yourself. Just say a word about why you wanted to include this in your conversation, your exploration of sports training, and what it was like to be a hands-on participant.
There were a couple of reasons I wanted to put myself in the book. I mean, one is that I cover so many topics and you know, really try to unpack a lot of science for a general reader. And I felt like having some kind of narrative thread would make that a little more of a fun journey, you know, feel a little bit more like a story and less like a textbook. So I thought that, you know, we needed a character, and hey, you know, I'm not doing anything else. So I was that character. And then the other thing is, I really, really want to communicate the fact that even though this book is about elite athletes, it's for people who are not, it's for, you know, regular people. It's for people whose ambition for themselves is just to be able to enjoy themselves without, you know, feeling pain or without feeling limited by aging. And I think putting myself in there maybe takes everything down to the level where it feels achievable, because I promise anybody who reads this book, you know, I am not somebody who anybody's going to be intimidated by my performance. And doing a lot of these things was, that example that you started with was a perfect one, because this is something, you know, I was on a machine called the VersaClimber that, you know, you'll see it in some high end gyms. It's sort of simulates climbing. And, that's not an exaggeration there. After 4 minutes, I thought I was going to throw up all over the floor of the gym, and everybody watching me thought I was going to throw up all over the floor of the gym. And then when I went home and I read about the workouts that some, you know, some like ultra marathoners or Ironmen do on this thing, I was like, oh my God. And I couldn't even do 4 minutes.
But you survived. You survived.
I survived, and I survived freezing myself, and I survived blood flow restriction training and some other things, and I'm here to tell the story.
That's very, very good. You say at one point in the book, the life of a high-level competitive athlete does not make for blooming health. And so often athletes who toil long and hard in the trenches, you know, end up with broken-down bodies, which is so tragic, and, of course, sometimes broken-down minds as well. And your book, of course, also points to perhaps a brighter future for more and more athletes whose careers can be extended with much less ultimate cost to themselves. So much more to explore, but we need to let you go. The book again is Play On, The New Science of Elite Performance at Any Age, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And the author is Jeff Berkovici. Jeff Berkovici, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, and thank you for writing such a fascinating book.
Thank you for a wonderful discussion.
And as we approach the top of the hour here on WGTD-HD, I want to tell you about the morning shows that are scheduled to air next week. On Monday, we will be paying memorial tribute to local theater organ legend Fred Hermes, who died earlier this week. I'm going to be replaying from the archives my memorable morning show recorded in the basement of Fred Hermes' home, where he constructed an extraordinary home theater, at the heart of which was a mighty Wurlitzer theater organ. So my conversation with Fred Hermes replayed on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, pays his monthly visit to the program, and with him will be the special guest speaker for Gateway's spring graduation. On Wednesday, I'll be speaking with Doug Instanis about the production that is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild. It is the sparkling, energetic musical Sister Act. On Thursday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program. And on Friday, we will have a couple of different interviews, including one with one of the funniest people in America, comedian Paula Poundstone, a frequent guest to public radio's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and responsible for her own popular podcast as well. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You will find the program archived on our website, WGTD.org. I'm Gregory Berg. Thank you.
And once again, support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show in WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. It's coming up on 9 o'clock. We'll join NPR for their network news at 9:00.